It's the basement.
Hello and welcome. You are listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM. The frequency is 103.7. The first pronouncement over minority rights in legislative bodies first surfaced in 1849 by the revolutionary Hungarian parliament of that time. Throughout the ages, the concept of minorities has evolved, and today international human rights law makes reference to the ethnic, religious, linguistic minorities and also to indigenous peoples. Minority rights are a legal framework designed to ensure that a specific group, which is in a vulnerable position in society, is able to achieve equality and is protected from persecution. The concept of minority rights today entails the protection from discrimination and persecution, protection and promotion of identity and the participation in political life. The first post-war international treaty to protect minorities, designed to protect them from the greatest threat to their existence, was the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. I am Darren Katkuti, your host for the next half hour. On today's show, It's Debatable, we shall be inquiring about the newly emerging debates over minority rights. To which extent shall we attribute credit to the value of minorities in our societies? Remember that you can join our conversation with your questions and comments by sending an email on info@mrsa.org.mt or by logging on our online forum on mrsa.org.mt. Joining me now is our academic contributor for today, Dr. Aslan Al-Shinawi, who lectures in political economy, Middle East politics and secularism at the University of Malta, and is the author of the book The Continuous Relevance of the Nation-State, the Political Economy of the Pharmaceutical Industry in Egypt. My other two guests for today are second-year international relations students Mikhail Pisani and Martina Portelli. I welcome you all to It's Debatable.
Thank you.
Dr. Al-Shinawi, let me start with you. What do we understand by the term rights?
Thank you, Darren. Before, the whole idea is about the variation between minority rights across different countries. But before that, we have to say rights, because it's important to answer what are rights. Rights are legal, social and ethical principles of freedom and some form of entitlement. And in fact, they decide what is allowed of people and what is owed to people. So it's related to the legal system, social convention, and some ethical theory.
When it comes to minority rights, what are exactly minority rights? What does it entail to classify as a minority?
Minority rights, today we speak of individual rights as applied to a group, as applied to members of a certain group that are different than the majority, either in terms of the race, language, ethnicity, religion, class, and more recently, sexuality itself, sexual orientation. These are groups that are in numbers, not necessarily in numbers, like we have the case of Bahrain, but generally we speak that they are minority in relation to the majority, and there is an approach now developing that people would like to give to these people the same rights given to the majority. However, even that sometimes becomes controversial, because the expression of collective rights sometimes is contradictory, because individual rights are not subject to public vote, and majority has no right to vote away the rights of minority. Now, the political function of rights is to protect minorities from oppression by majorities. But the smallest minority itself is the individual. So we go back to the individual right. Because if we go back to the basic minority, everyone agrees, is the individual itself. So even minority rights, if we analyze it, it becomes debatable again.
Okay. So from what I can conclude here is that we have an evolving concept of minority rights, which is ultimately entrenched in international human rights law. However, what is the history behind this concept of minority rights? How did it become prominent at the forefront of the political scenario?
What is important to realize that, as we said, the fact that human rights is related to social conflicts throughout history, in fact, if we dig and we try to find the origin of every right, what we consider right today we have, there is a great social conflict behind it. If we remember the rights of colored people, the rights of so many minorities. So certainly it has a long history intertwined with the social conflicts across many countries. But recently, of course, also we have to realize that the whole concept, what is considered minority, is changing. Very dynamic, people have to realize. Because the concept of what is minority is changing. What is today minority maybe was not a minority 100 years ago. Maybe in the future also we will have minorities that today we do not consider them. So it's extremely dynamic and evolving because it's related to our concepts of the society, of the legal system, of social theory, of political theory.
So ultimately, this all boils down to the question of geography, which plays an important role in this evolvement of human rights. What can you tell me about this?
Certainly, Darren. Why geography? Because the fact that we said human minority rights is related to the social, legal, ethical system, certainly we do realize that across geography, people have different social background. I mean, history itself is different in different parts. There are different religions. And we all know that most history of the legal system has roots in religion. I mean, Islam, Christianity, Buddhism. The fact that we have different religions means different social systems, different understanding, and certainly different legal systems. So that's the problem of international legal systems that can address minorities across many countries. People have different understanding.
I have one final question for now. Can you explain further on these different attitudes which governments tend to adopt vis-à-vis the fate and integration of minorities? Ultimately, I believe this differs in different parts of the world when it comes to democracy and non-democratic governments.
Certainly. What we consider democratic and non-democratic, of course, at the most basic level, there are obvious differences. But then, of course, in my view, personally, it has to also to do with elements of the whole economic and wealth creation. I mean, like the case I can mention of Bahrain. I mean, in Bahrain, the majority are, that is the whole thing, the majority are the Shiite people based on some division of Islam. But as such, they are ruled by the minority who are Sunni. I mean, the majority are, as such, in this concept of this meeting here we are talking with Darren, become a minority. But in numbers, they are majority, just because they are Shiite, and the minority, the ruling elite in Bahrain, and you see on the news, they have problems, they are, as such, minority.
I thank you, Dr. Ashnawi, for your introduction so far. Thank you for joining us. We hope to speak to you again other time on It's Debatable. The debate on minority rights now continues with my other two guests for today, Mikael and Martina Portelli, who are second-year international relations students. Martina, I invited you to this show because you seem to have, you strongly advocated the complete integration of minorities. Today we talk of minority rights as a legal framework and part of international human rights law. However, what do you say, is this a prevalent issue in the international scenario?
Well, one of the age-old sayings associated with the definition of democracy is majority rule, minority rights. However, the safeguarding and even the recognizing of minority rights has been an issue on the international scenario for a number of years. When faced with the term minority, it is generally regarded as something to do with numbers. This is a bit erroneous, as a minority is defined as a sociological group that does not make up the politically dominant voting majority of a total population. This could be dependent on a number of things, and thus these minorities should be protected.
I can also see that Mick over here, you seem to have a more holistic approach for the situation. What do you have to say to what Martina has just told us?
Well, Darren, when I was invited to the show and asked to argue the negative aspects of minority rights, I was taken a bit aback at the possibility of arguing against such rights, which are ultimately related to fundamental human rights. But I realized the short-sightedness of this argument. We shouldn't be debating in favor of minority rights or to what extent we should have minority rights or respect the rights of the minorities, but rather we should go beyond minority rights. You mentioned that in your introduction that minority rights is a type of legal framework. This implies the fact that we're telling people how to act and react with one another, you know, but this undermines us as human beings, you know, just like an economy. Let us be free, a liberal market, you know. It is in human nature for us to, you know, to bond with each other and find solutions to our problems. So rather than giving laws for this particular person because he's of this particular belief, you know, and telling him, listen, with this other person of another belief, you should act this way. You know, just let us be.
Okay.
You know? So it's beyond minority rights, is what I'm saying. It's not against the rights of the minorities.
In your research, Martina, you also researched about the situation in Cyprus, and you have done a profound research about it. How can you tell us something about the human rights minority rights situation over there?
Well, first of all, while I admire Mick's quite optimistic position, over the years, minorities have struggled to be recognized in order to have their rights safeguarded. It is important for this to happen, because without this recognition, the members forming part of the minority are denied certain basic needs. One can cite the example of the Turkish Cypriots living in the Republic of Cyprus, which make up 18% of the population. These Turkish Cypriots are not even recognized as a minority and thus automatically have a lower standard of living than other citizens because they do not have access to certain basic things.
But you know, essentially, if the government does something to benefit the minorities, it's going to be at the expense of the majority. Dr. Arslan Shinawi once said in his lectures that politics is the mind, whereas the economy is the stomach. Therefore, when the economy is ill, certain policies need to be made to cure the illness. So it is on this basis that the government will decide whether to recognize a minority group or not. Now, please do understand that the views I express here are not necessarily my personal opinions, but rather an analysis on how I view the world we live in today. You know, how a government reacts to having different cultural, ethnic groups within the same state. You know, a government thinks economically as it wants to survive, just like a human wanting to survive a famine, for example. So if there's a sudden influx of migrants of some sort, you know, the government will be more ready to recognize their rights and help them integrate better into society only if their presence in the state would be beneficial to the majority. But by that is meant that, you know, the minority will contribute to the growth of the economy.
Mick, what you are saying over here brings me to my next observation. It seems for Martina, it's imperative for her that minority rights are fully recognized and protected under all circumstances and by all governments. Why is this?
What Mick is saying is somewhat reductionist. If a person's rights should only be protected if they contribute to the economy, completely negates the importance of the person, of the individual person, or of the group. So it is quite difficult for anybody to have their rights safeguarded just because they are of economic benefit to the state they are living in.
I thank you all for your input so far. We shall be stopping for a short break. Keep listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM. Coming up right after our break is our special guest for today, Ruth, and we shall be speaking and we shall be asking her for her input on the subject of minority rights. Welcome you all back. You are listening to It's Debatable on Campus FM. The frequency is 103.7. I am Darren Katkut, your host for today's show. Today we are discussing the newly emerging debate over minority rights and the value of minorities in our societies. Remember that you can join our conversation with your comments and questions by sending an email on info@mrsa.org.mt or by logging on our online forum on mrsa.org.mt. Joining me now in the studio is my special guest for today, Ruth. I welcome you to It's Debatable.
Thank you.
Ms. Baldacchino lectures in queer studies at the University of Malta, and she is a member of ILGA and a PhD candidate within the Department of Sociology at the Trinity College in Dublin. Her research concerns ethnographies of queer migration, a qualitative research looking at the interrelationships of queer migrants' lives, connections and perspectives. Ms. Ruth, when we speak of minority rights today, we not only include their in full political participation, but we're also concerned with individual minorities and individual rights. What can you tell us about the political development of the lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender community?
The LGBT, as we call it in short, movement has now a long history behind it, and it all started, we trace its beginnings in 1969 in New York in the US, and since then, you know, there were many changes which saw the LGBT movement growing. I wanted to quote, to start with a quote into answering, trying to answer your question. And it goes something like this. It says, "We must reject persecution of people because of their sexual orientation or gender identity, who may be arrested, detained or executed for being lesbian, gay, bisexual or transgender. I understand that sexual orientation and gender identity raise sensitive cultural issues, but cultural practice cannot justify any violation of human rights. When our fellow humans are persecuted because of their sexual orientation or gender identity, we must speak out. Human rights are human rights everywhere for everyone." Now, this is something which the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said on the 25th of January 2011, in a reaction to the kind of the atmosphere at the United Nations in relation to persecutions of LGBT people. Now, this didn't happen overnight, and as I said, it's a result of 4 decades of the LGBT movement's work in relation to the rights. And what we've been doing as international associations for LGBT rights was to focus on individuals, was not to focus on groups as minorities, but to say, listen, there are treaties, there are existing human rights frameworks, and they apply to everyone. Everyone has their rights, and we can use those to protect LGBT people as well. I wanted to point out, because in the last couple of years, a group of experts have met up and came up with a number of principles, which they called the Yogyakarta principles. Which basically are a set of principles dealing with international human rights law as it applies to people of diverse sexual orientations and gender identities. It's called Yogyakarta because it was compiled in the city of Yogyakarta in Indonesia.
These Yogyakarta principles, which you speak about, how were they received by the international community and the state actors?
Yes, they were launched a couple of years ago on international and national levels. And the idea was to encourage states, national governments to transpose them or implement them within the human rights framework of their own countries. So far, very few countries have responded positively, and I'll give an example of the Dutch government, who I think it was in 2009, the Dutch government decided to incorporate the Yogyakarta principles within the human rights framework of the country, and in that way ensuring that, you know, everyone is protected by the human rights framework of that country. We are still encouraging many people, many governments rather, to adopt these principles because we believe that we didn't invent anything new. You know, we just used the current human rights framework to kind of reach out to as many individuals as possible.
So do you figure out that this is what went wrong with the complete implementation of...
Well, there is still objection to the idea of including sexual orientation and gender identity in human rights, international human rights framework, because some governments argue that, you know, these are special rights and there's no place for such rights. So we've been focusing our work on... The reality is that around the world, people still face violations because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. And that includes rapes, tortures, killings, you know, and on an international level, we've been trying to approach this on a more comprehensive and collective manner, notwithstanding the opposition of some governments.
And what do you think are the future prospects for the LGBT movement?
There are many prospects. I mean, we've seen lots of changes over the past 10 to 15 years. We work with institutions like the European Commission, the Council of Europe, and the United Nations. And within these institutions, we've seen how change is happening in terms of support for LGBT people. so much still needs to be done, and however we feel that we are on the right track to kind of incorporate LGBT people within the international mainstream international human rights framework.
That was Ruth, my special guest for today. We are discussing minority rights. Back before the break, Martina was arguing that the rights of minorities should be recognized by all state actors. Mick, what are your thoughts on this observation?
What comes to mind is the idea of minority-minority racism, basically where one minority considers another minority to be somehow less worthy of equality and respect. You know, it won't be long before in the United States, for example, it will be mainly comprised of minorities such as the Asian Americans, Latino Americans, African Americans. So what are we going to do? Give separate rights to different groups of people? I mean, imagine this. For example, if the African American minority get government aid on the basis of being discriminated against prior to the 1950s, thus recognizing their right as American citizens. This might upset the Latino Americans, who will not be given this financial aid, you know, causing animosity and hostility between the two minorities.
So this brings me to another observation. I mean, you're mentioning here the problems which might be created. So what is the solution about, after all?
Well, putting it simply, we should just give all minorities the same rights, equal rights for all minorities.
And there I agree. I actually agree with you there. But and because of that, then we're going beyond just minority rights. You know, I mean, look at the Western world. You know, it's growing more secularized. This will definitely lead to an increase in minority groups because of the growing number of faith-based religions, you know, small communities of people who believe in a particular thing, philosophy, call it whatever you like. So rather than becoming united, the world is becoming more individualized and a sense of, like a sense of individualization among the people.
I would like also to focus on these examples which you are giving from the Western world. I know for a fact that in August 2010, the issue of minority rights became quite prominent in the international relations scenario. I am, of course, speaking about the Roma migrants issue in France and how and the way that Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, treated about them. I know that, Martina, you have conducted some research about it in your studies. So what are your views on this?
Yes, so the eviction of the Roma. The French government's eviction of the Roma sparked a lot of backlash and criticism, and some of it even came from the European Union itself. The EU Commissioner for Justice, Viviane Reding, was exceptionally harsh in her criticism, calling the policy disturbing and even going as far as to compare it to what the Nazis did in the Second World War. A leaked French memo highlighted the fact that France was focusing on the expulsion of a specific ethnic group, which originally called for, and I quote, systematic operation to dismantle illegal camps, making a priority of those of the Roma. This obviously exacerbated existing prejudices and was completely uncalled for, since the evicted Roma, as citizens of the EU, will be perfectly entitled to come back to France whenever they like. If it was such a routine procedure, it would not have sparked such backlash from the EU, which was ready to start infringement measures against France.
Mick, you certainly have differing views on this, right?
Well, I agree with Martina on the fact that the method used by the government, you know, might not have been the best to choose. But
so, what, in your opinion, should be the solution?
What I wanted to say was that we have to see the situation in context. That is, at this time, when the Roma immigrants were being sent home, there was a national debate going on, that of the need to raise the retirement age, and this was causing a lot of talk, a lot of debate, a lot of, you know, unrest amongst the people, amongst the nationals, and so therefore, to divert media attention from this issue of retirement age, this document was leaked, you know, to cause a bit of a scandal so that the media would feed on this and would focus on the expulsion of the Roma immigrants. So basically, my point is that it was used as a distraction for something else.
Whether a distraction or not, the Roma were still discriminated against, and as shown by the by what the European Union said, it was wrong. So they shouldn't have done that.
True, very true. And I personally agree with you, but I guess the French government chose the lesser of the two evils.
Ultimately, what are your views on what is being done to recognize and safeguard the rights of minorities at the international level?
Well, if we take the European Union as an example, it started being more active in the field of minority protection at around the beginning of the 1990s. However, it still does not have such a strong acquis with regard to these issues. The treaties do not mandate the protection of minorities, which are not even mentioned in them. So if a minority is not mentioned in that specific treaty, that minority is thus not protected. So this has to be changed.
Okay.
The thing is that recognition is of the minority groups is in the interest of the government. Unfortunately, many governments seem to see things on a short-term basis. Minorities have no voice, they're disunited, they can't fight for their rights, they're not aware of their rights probably, and, you know, too many rights, there's racial tension, quotas, gangs.
So what are the future prospects, especially when with regards to non-democratic governments?
Well, that's the thing. My views here are I'm focusing on democratic governments, on Western world, to be honest. The thing is that these governments of the Western world should have a long-term vision, and we're getting there. You know, this long-term vision is basically that the politicians would realize that there's a lot of benefit. For example, if irregular immigrants are properly integrated into society, these people want to work and they earn a living. If they earn money, then they will have money to spend. You know, thus the economy develops and grows. And
Martina and Mikael, I thank you very much for your contributions. The setting was a good debate about minority rights, and a lot of valid points were raised. We hope to speak to you again some other time in our future shows. Today we were discussing minority rights on It's Debatable. Remember that our debate continues online, and you can post your questions and comments on our forum, mirsa.org.mt. It's Debatable is a conjoint initiative between the Department of International Relations within the University of Malta and MIRSA, the Malta International Relations Student Association. A special thank you goes to Dr. Isabel Caldeja, who heads the International Relations Department, lecturer Dr. Insela Arslan Al-Shinawi, and Ms. Joyce Gregg for their input. I, Darren Katkuta, thank you, our dear listeners, for joining us today, and I invite you to stay tuned to Campus FM.
It's Debatable.